This is the New York Jazz Workshop in Conversation With podcast. I'm your host, CJ Shern. I am very honored today to have with me a multidimensional musician, multi-instrumentalist Jerry Gibbs. We are going to be talking about today his career and also his brand new album with his band Thrasher People, Our People, his 12th album as a leader. So Jerry, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, CJ.
All right. So let's start out with, for people who may not be familiar with you, you grew up in L.A. You were born here in New York City, and you are the son of the legendary vibraphonist Terry Gibbs. You played drums at the age of 4. You had a drum set given to you by Buddy Rich, correct?
You had to embarrass me with all that, especially the Terry Gibbs part. That's my, he's my best buddy. All of that's all correct. Yeah, I was born in New York, but I think I left within a few days because I was just born here in passing, and then went right to Los Angeles.
And in Los Angeles at that time, that was quite a scene. I mean, the session players and everything that were coming out of there, yeah, was just, that was an amazing scene. So you had been around that. And just talk about what it was like to be around the Los Angeles scene before you moved to New York at the age of 22.
Well, Los Angeles had a great scene back then. I would say that there were more places to play from what it seems like. I don't live in Los Angeles anymore, but I do go there to visit my family and play gigs from time to time. There were a lot of what we call Chitlin Circuit clubs that were in Los Angeles. They weren't big paying gigs, but there might have been about maybe, I don't know, 13 or 14 places to play around Los Angeles back in about 1983, 84, when I was like 19 and, 19, 20 years of age. I was really fortunate to get hooked up with a lot of great people at that time, like between ages 19 and 20. I started playing gigs with Alice Coltrane. I played every Sunday with Donald Byrd, playing his Blackbird music. Got a chance to do some things with Benny Maupin, Billy Childs.
Doug Carn.
Yeah, Doug was one of the first people to hire me. Actually, Alan Broadbent might have gave me my first gigs when I was like 16, outside of my father. And then all the guys from The Tonight Show, Conti Gandoli, and Frank Rosolino wasn't part of The Tonight Show, but all the West Coast guys, I had chances to play with Joe Farrell. A lot of really great Ernie Watts. So there was a lot of stuff going on in Los Angeles. And then a lot of people that don't have big names in the jazz world that were great, that were all around Los Angeles at the time. But there were a lot of Chitlin Circuit clubs. I played every Sunday at Marla's Memory Lane, like I said, with Donald Byrd. And I played with Doug Carn every Monday and Wednesday at a little place in South Central Los Angeles. So there was a lot of really cool stuff to do back then. Of course, my rent was only $325. And gigs back then paid $100, almost like they local ones do now. So it only took 3 or 4 gigs to pay your whole rent. Playing local gigs. So that
was
easy.
Amazing. You won't find that today, that's for sure.
Oh, no. Uh-uh.
What was it like playing with Benny Maupin?
Well, I met Benny. I could tell this here on the radio. I met Benny the first time I played with Donald Byrd, and Donald wanted to hear me. So he asked me to come down to his Sunday gig and sit in. And so I went and I sat in. And Benny came over to me and he said, "Hey, can I get your number? Man, I'd love to call you to play sometime." And I said, "Oh, man, anytime." I was 18 years old and I was already a big Herbie Hancock M1 Dishi fanatic. And through that, I bought a bunch of Benny Maupin records, Jewel in the Lotus, and a lot of different things that he was on. And so I was really excited. I said, "Anytime." He said, "Can you play in the evenings?" I said, "Anytime. I'll play at 3 a.m, doesn't matter." And he called me about a week later, and I was living in Hollywood, and he called me at midnight. He said, "Hey, Jerry, it's Benny Maupin. Am I calling too late?" And I was like, no, this is great. He said, "Man, would you like to play?" And I said, "Man, anytime." He said, "Can you meet me in 2 hours?" And I said, 2 hours now, it's midnight. I mean, at 2 in the morning? He said, "Yeah." And I thought, it's pouring down rain outside. They were having like flash floods. And I said, "Where do you want to meet?" And he goes, "Can you meet me at Forest Lawn Cemetery?" And I was like, wait, where? And he said, "Forest Lawn Cemetery." I said, "Where?" He goes, "Well, when you get there, there'll be a guard. He'll give you a map and he'll show you where to meet me." So he said, "By the way, pack all your gongs and all your percussion toys and everything and drive safely." So I drove 30 minutes to Forest Lawn Cemetery. It's like a cemetery with 50,000 bodies up there. I mean, it's huge, up on a hill in Los Angeles.
I can imagine.
And so I drive and the gatekeeper says, "Oh, yeah, Mr. Maupin, this is where you go." And so I'm following the map and I'm going around and it's pouring down rain and I'm looking for a sign. And I see underneath this freeway underpass where the graves go underneath, and I hear this kind of sound. I'm going like, what is that? So that has to be Benny. And so I'm driving down this road in a cemetery, just graves around me, pouring down rain, thunder. And I got my drums, my gongs, and all my stuff in the car that I packed. And I'm driving, and I see him under the underpass, and he's waving me down. So he comes over. He helps me get all my stuff out of the car. He helps me get everything set up and everything. And I'm not really paying attention. I'm setting up next to some gravestones that are underneath the freeway underpass where there's lighting. And then I said, "Hey, Benny, where's the saxophone?" And, behind one of the graves, he doesn't pull out a saxophone. He pulls out bagpipes. Now, I'm 18 years old, and he pulls
really?
Out.
That's crazy.
We played duet, bagpipe and drums for 3 hours without stopping. From 2 in the morning till 5 in the morning when the sun started coming up, it rained the whole time, thundering and graves, and you can see the water on each side of the underpass. And that was my first experience playing with Benny Maupin. L.A., that's L.A.
Wow. One of my all-time favorite Benny Maupin moments is on Speedball, on the Lee Morgan Live at the Lighthouse, mm-hmm. the 3-CD version that came out in 96, when Lee gives the introduction at the end saying he's got to put some arsenic in his reed because he's not going to get no more chances. That is, that was like one of the craziest things. And, there were like a couple of other performances with Jack DeJohnette that night. I wish they had unearthed those.
Yeah, because it's only on one song.
Yeah. Because that was just, that's my favorite version of Speedball, period. I listen
with Jack
to it
playing.
All the time. Yeah. And Jack is another dream interview of mine that I would love to do because he's been somebody who has just been a hero of mine for a long time.
Yeah, Benny's great. I mean, I tell that story to people and they think, oh, he's crazy, but he's really not. He's actually very normal.
He's very down to earth. Yeah.
Very down, very normal. I mean, L.A. was just so full of so many incredible musicians and stuff. Billy Higgins was like, for a lot of people, was very helpful. He was very helpful to me. He hooked me up on some subs. I subbed for Woody Shaw with him once, and that was unbelievable.
Oh, man.
18, and you're going to play with Woody Shaw,
Now, you had moved to New York in 1987 at the age of 23, and you were the substitute for whenever Wynard Harper couldn't make it. And what I remember about the Harper brothers was that at the time, around like 1990 or so, they were considered to be one of the heirs to the Jazz Messengers. And that must have been such a great experience, being able to play with Wynard and his brother, people of that caliber.
Yeah, when I first moved to New York, I moved in 88, actually. I think my bio says 87, but I think it was
right,
around,
it does. It says 87.
Yeah, I got to fix that. I think it was around 88. And I got here, and I went to the Blue Note a couple of nights because they had a jam session, and I wasn't able to sit in. They didn't know who I was, and it just, a couple of nights went by. And one night I was talking to the bass player, Michael Bowie, who played in the band. And I told him I had moved here from Los Angeles and some of the people I had worked with. And he had told Justin Robinson, to let me sit in at the jam session. So Justin let me sit in, and we played a tune, and the tune ended, and nobody said anything, and I just walked off the stage and grabbed my coat and made my way through the snow out towards the subway. And as I'm walking, Justin comes running outside, and he yells down the street, "Yo, yo," and I turn around, and he's telling me, like, "Come here." And then he said, "Hey, are you working tomorrow night?" And I was like, "No." And he says, "Can you work the rest of the week with me at the Blue Note?" So I started doing that. Then Wynard heard me. And then, yeah, it was very cool. Wynard, I guess he saw something in me at the time. And so I became kind of a sub. Sometimes when the Harper Brothers would play at the Vanguard, Wynard might be running late. He might have a record date, or he was at the time, I think he might have still been doing stuff with Betty Carter or Billy Taylor. I can't really remember, but he had some things that he was still doing. And every once in a while, it would cause him maybe to miss the first set or be late, and he would call me to be the sub for that. And so I would come down there and play a couple tunes until he showed up. I mean, he knew he was going to be late, so it wasn't that he just showed up late to his own gig. And then after that, Wynard hooked me up with the Mingus organization, the guitar. They had a guitar band with Larry Coryell, and through that, then I started working with Larry's band and a whole bunch of things. So, yeah, Wynard was very helpful to me when I first came here, you know, very helpful to me.
Yeah, Wynard was around everywhere at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that very well, yes. So now you have your 12th album as a leader, which just came out a few months ago in June, called Our People. And I find this album very, very interesting because it is an all-encompassing approach to music. It really, you should just call it Jerry Gibbs music, I would say, or something, because, or from the creative.
All right, let me see. Hold on, let me make a call. I'll see if the next batch that comes out will change the title. See, they'll go for it.
Yeah, because you know, it's your previous band before this, Kenny Barron and Ron Carter. They've made some great records, and you have a great relationship with them. So you wanted to try something new with this band, and amongst the three main players, Alex Collins, Gianluca Renzi, Mayu Saiki, and your wife on vocals, everybody plays about 40 instruments.
Between the five of us, yeah.
Yes.
What happened was I had the trio with Ron and Kenny, and we did three records, and we had different guests, Cassandra Wilson, Roy Hargrove, Warren Wolf, Larry Golding's on organ, and Steve Wilson. And we had done three number one records in a row on radio. And at that time, I really wanted to start a band that I could rehearse constantly with, and really spend time with a band that I could take on the road. Ron and Kenny are two of the busiest people on the planet, so that's going to be impossible. We have played live together, but it's very hard to get that to happen. And so even as supportive as Ron has been and Kenny, it's a very hard thing to do. So I went looking for multi-instrumentalists. I wanted to find guys that played more than one instrument. And I first found Alex. And so the first record we did was called Weather or Not. And it was one CD of weather report music and one CD of original music. So you say I have 12 records. That's true. Two of my records are double. So some people will actually say, well, he's got 14 records. But, you know, I mean, if you were going to collect all my original, all my, you know, solo CDs, I guess it would be 14 that you would have in your player. But yeah, there's 12 different packages, right?
Yeah, it's right here on my desk here. I see the Weather or Not and a bunch of others, yes.
And so with that one, I didn't really go to the everybody's going to play all the instruments that they play. And then after that, and the reason why is because I had been kind of gearing my records towards radio, you know, to and again, that record went to number one. So actually, this sounds over the top bragging to say, but Looking in the last 23 years that Jazz Week has kept track of number one radio stats, these are the only records that have four times in a row. There's been four other artists that have done three in a row, but this was four in a row.
The Thrasher Trio records you're talking about.
Yeah,
right?
and then the Whether or Not, which was the new band.
Wow.
Yeah, with Alex Collins and Hans Glavižnik was the first bass player in that band. But I went to the and the reason why I'm saying all that is to set it up that I went to the record label Wailing City Sound that I've been with for the last 12 years, and they said, okay, what's next for number five for radio? And I said, I can't do that again. I can't make another record for radio. I need to make a record of something that's going to showcase this band. This band can walk on stage and have 40 instruments surrounding them. And I really want to document that, and it won't do well on radio. We'll be lucky to even get in the top 50. And, kind of knowing how radio works and gearing my other records towards radio, I was correct about this. I think it went to 47, and it stayed in the top 50 for maybe 5 weeks, and where the other record had stayed in the charts for over 30 weeks. I didn't make the record for radio. I had something in mind, and I knew it kind of entertained a combination of progressive rock records that I grew up listening to, although we're jazz.
I was just going
to
say that,
but
yeah.
We're jazz musicians, so it's actually it's much more jazz oriented than that. But it's also movie music because of all the strings. The Gianluca Renzi plays all the string parts, and Miyazaki plays all the flute parts. You know, all the way from the top to the bottom. So when people hear the record, it starts off with 100 voices. And it's five of us overdubbed 20 times, and it sounds like a big MGM movie soundtrack introduction with the crashing cymbals and the strings. And so this record was a huge overdub session. I built my own studio a couple years ago, so I was able to do this in my own studio because budget wise, I mean, we spent 5 days, 14 hours a day recording this. It would have been really huge. And I was able to do this myself. And so that's kind of why I did the record. And with the climate of everything that's going on, I don't like to get into a whole political thing, but some of the things that really bother me about what's happened in this country and how certain entities are separating and people are going back to their corners again after whatever progress we've made up until a couple of years ago. I wanted to take all the influences that every culture has had on me, the friends that I have, not the culture so much as the friends. I have friends in Africa, friends in India, friends in Mexico, friends in Germany, friends in Poland, friends in America, friends in Costa Rica, I mean, all over the world. And I wanted to take all of those influences. I've had one or two reviews where the reviewer really misunderstood this record and had words to say about, well, this doesn't sound like African music, and it doesn't sound like Jamaican music, and it doesn't sound like Hispanic music, and it doesn't sound like Korean music to me. It's like, it wasn't meant, I'm not borrowing the music from the culture. I'm borrowing my influence from those people, from those cultures, and interpreting it funneled through how I hear music. So just because it was African music didn't necessarily mean that it had to have a bunch of percussion instruments or that it had to be 6/8, you know. It could be something else that for me, this is what it sounded like, especially that I've taken a few trips to Africa, and there are influences, many influences from those trips, but not the music, me borrowing from a particular music, trying to mimic that culture's music. Does that make sense? Or?
Sure, it does. I actually want to go back to a point you just made, that what you tried to do with the music was base it on the influences from friends that you have from other cultures. The first thing that I thought of when
and experiences and people that I've been around.
Right.
Right.
The first thing that I thought of when listening to this record, I don't know if you're familiar with a multi-instrumentalist and vocalist by the name of Stefan Mikus.
I know his name, and I haven't really checked him out.
He's
but I know his name.
Had over like 30 years, a lot of records on ECM, and he takes like 10 years between records, almost in the way that like Enya and people like that have done, you know, years between albums. And what he does with his music is he takes a lot of instruments from all over the world, but he doesn't play them in that cultural dialect. It's all of a very idiosyncratic nature. And that's what I was thinking of when I listened to this record.
Yeah. You know, I'm the opposite. I have 30 records in my mind ready to go, and it just is when the record label says, okay, it's time, go do the next one, and then I decide what feels right to me at that time. So when I did this record, I spent 2 days, about 15 hours a day. I wrote all the music. I put it on the computer. I started sending it to the guys, see what they thought of it. And, of course, everybody said, oh, my God, this is going to take forever to record because you've just wrote music for sometimes 50 instruments at once, and there's only 5 of us doing it. But everybody was down to do it. You know, it's funny because it's a problem that I have. Like, I just finished writing music now, 14 tunes for the next record, which will be a trio with string quartet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I just get obsessed. I hear something in my head, and I'll just spend a few days, maybe 16, 17 hours in a day behind the computer and the keyboard and with the drums to put some fake dummy drum tracks down on the fake keyboard and string tracks that I'll do in my studio just so I can hear what it sounds like. And then once it's done, then I have to try to be calm and relax and not go to the next record because this one hasn't been recorded yet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's kind of, for me, yeah, I wish it was possible to put 4 or 5 out every year just so I can get those things out of my system and out of my head and be done with it.
I could kind of relate to that a little bit as a writer, because sometimes I'll be thinking of 3 or 4 different things I want to write, but I have to focus on that one thing and get that done before I go to the next. Like, I've been working on an essay about reassessing the electric period of Miles Davis, and there's all of these reviews and podcasts and other things I have to do at the same time, and it's just like, okay, let me just focus on the one thing. So I could relate to that just a little bit in a different
right.
way.
Well, if you're into a lot of different things, it makes it really difficult, you know, to sit with one thing because your brain wants to get 5 or 6 things done all at once.
Yeah, it's the creative mind, really.
It's a problem.